Blog Talk Radio.
Great stuff today. I don't know, man. I don't know if you saw the segment, but it's making some waves, partly because I kind of forced it out there and was promoting it endlessly. But the new atheist versus progressive treaty, I guess you could call it, ceasefire. Long story short, it didn't work. I mean, no. I heard from some of the people who even were referenced in the segment, it's not going to work. Sam Harris was like, hey, I appreciate the effort, and I think he actually meant it, which was nice that he said that, but, and then he went on to say, like, it's not 50-50 blame, yada, yada, yada. I heard from another person who I referenced in the clip privately, and they were like, yeah, decent points, but X, Y, and Z. So I'm trying to bridge the gap, man. Didn't work, probably won't work, but it is what it is. What are you going to do? We'll be moving past that today and talking about many other things. Jeb Bush is doubling down on his support of the Iraq war. We're going to kick it off with that in a second. And yet again, I'm going to rip this guy to shreds, and I'm looking forward to ripping him to shreds. We have, geez, what else, man? I got a story about a guy named Bernard Noble. This is a guy who is a victim of the drug war. And oftentimes when we talk about the drug war, we don't really give personal stories, so it feels, you know, it almost feels too cold and too pragmatic, and, you know, it doesn't get, like, sympathetic enough. You can't really feel what's happening because you're not referencing any specific people. Well, here we're going to reference somebody specific, and you're going to see how criminal the drug war is, really, in my opinion. And later on in the show, we have the most disastrous abortion policy you've ever heard and the consequences of that, and we have a study that shows you what one of the biggest killers in the world is, and nobody gives a fuck about it. That sounds harsh, but it absolutely is true. So, let's get started here. And I want to kick it off with Jeb Bush. We've been hammering this guy lately, but we should continue to hammer him, because when you hear some of the stuff he's saying, you're going to wonder why everybody in the media is not hammering him. Jeb Bush is doubling down on his brother's Iraq war. He recently came out and said that he kind of sort of supports it, and he would redo it if he were to become president. Here he is with some follow-up comments on that.
I'll tell you, though, that taking out Saddam Hussein turned out to be a pretty good deal. In 2009, Iraq was fragile but secure. It was mission was accomplished in the way that there was security there, and it was because of the heroic efforts of the men and women in the United States military that it was so. And that is a fact. And you can't take that away from anybody who served, and you can't take that away from, you can't rewrite history in that regard.
No, actually, you're the one that's rewriting history. You're saying, oh, it was all hunky-dory. It was basically a utopia in Iraq in 2009. That's what I would say. No, but that's not true. You basically set up a pressure cooker. Just because there's not a problem right now in that, in a brief time span in 2009, didn't mean that it was going to stay that way. And in fact, we know it's not going to stay that way because, as John McCain of all people said about the Middle East, you're playing a game of whack-a-mole when it comes to fighting jihadists. So this idea that, like, oh my God, we had 1 month where there wasn't violence every single day, it's victory. But that's not true. And also, we were there at the time. So that's your idea of victory? Like, if we're there and there's relatively less violence, but then by your own logic, aren't you saying, well, we should kind of stay there forever? And I guess you are, because, again, your plan involves going back in there. And let's be clear about this. Lindsey Graham, another guy in the Republican Party who's running for president, he said very clearly, you don't leave. He was asked this question. We covered the story a while ago. They're like, well, what do? When do you declare victory and get out? I forget who the interview was with, either CNBC or Bloomberg or something like that. And his response was, well, you don't leave. So you want to do permanent occupation. You just want to stay there and, police the region. And some people fire back and say, well, Kyle, yeah, we still have troops in Germany, so, you know, that's not like a crazy idea. And I don't want them in Germany. All the money that we spend for our 900 military bases in over 100 different countries, we could take that money and put it towards something that really would make a difference, like universal health care for everybody or universal education or something like that. I don't want to be a superpower anymore. I don't want to be the world policeman. I don't want to be an imperialist nation. And oftentimes we continue to breed hatred around the world when we act like that. So, no, because there was a brief window in 2009 when there was relatively less violence, that doesn't mean that it was a success. And by the way, I told you just the other day about this. This was a trick that the Republicans used around that time span. Whenever the violence increased after the surge, what would they say? That proves the surge is working because now we know the insurgency is in its last throes, they would say. Then the violence would go down for 1 month, and they'd say, see, it worked. There's less violence. But then the next month, the violence would go up, and they'd say, see, the surge is working. Insurgency is in its last throes again. Well, which is it? You're setting up a non-falsifiable claim. When there's more violence, you say it works. When there's less violence, you say it works. So no matter what, you're going to say, it works. But the most egregious part of that was, you heard it at the beginning, taking out Saddam Hussein proved to be a pretty good deal. No, it didn't. Nowhere near it. In fact, I'm going to go ahead and prove it to you. So if there's anybody who's listening to the show right now and they're wishy-washy on this point, or they say, well, you know, I see good arguments on both sides, or whatever, if this is your line of thinking, let me just give you facts. Let me just give you numbers. And you come to your own conclusion about this. So here are the consequences of the Iraq War. First of all, there were 189,000 direct war deaths, which doesn't include the hundreds of thousands more that died due to war-related hardships. This is according to Business Insider, by the way. Next, we have 4,488 U.S. service personnel killed directly. 32,223 troops that were injured. That doesn't include PTSD. There were 134,000 civilians killed directly. There were 655,000 persons who died in Iraq since the invasion that would not have died if the invasion had not occurred. So in other words, part of that is the sectarian violence that we riled up when we went in there and destabilized the region. Let's continue. There are 2.8 million persons who remain either internally displaced or have fled the country. $1.7 trillion is the amount in war expenses spent by the U.S. Treasury through fiscal year 2013. Obviously, that's more now. $5,000 was spent on the Iraq war every single second. Every second. That's U.S. tax dollars. That's middle-class Americans, poor Americans. $350,000 is the cost to deploy just one American military member. $490 billion is the amount in war benefits owed to veterans. $7 trillion with a T, trillion, is the projected interest payments due by the year 2053, because, of course, a lot of the war was paid for with borrowed money. Whatever happened to fiscal responsibility, conservatives and George Bush, you started this war and you put it on the credit card. $20 billion is the amount paid to KBR, the contractor responsible for equipment and services. $3 billion is the amount of KBR payments that Pentagon auditors considered, quote, questionable. I don't just consider them questionable. I know what happened to that money. It was fucking stolen. It was taken for profit. $3 billion was taken by defense contractors and put right into their pockets. Okay. $60 billion is the amount paid for reconstruction, which was ruled largely a waste due to corruption and, quote, shoddy work. Still not done. $12 billion is the cost per month of the war by 2008. Here's what's missing, $546 million in spare parts, 190,000 guns, including 110,000 AK-47s. it's a great place to lose guns, right? Iraq, it's not like there's going to be some monstrous group called ISIS that rises from the abyss and then takes those weapons. Oh, that's right, that's exactly what happened. 40% is the increase in Iraqi oil revenue. $5 billion is the revenue from Iraqi oil in 2003. $85 billion is the revenue from Iraqi oil in 2011. That's a big increase. $150 billion is the amount that oil companies are expected to invest in oil development over the next decade. $75 billion is the approximate amount expected to go to American subcontracting companies, the largest of all of them being Halliburton, the one that Dick Cheney was involved with. And finally, I got one last number for you here that puts it all into perspective. Zero. You know what that is? The number of weapons of mass destruction found in Iraq. Now, remember, the first thing they said was Saddam's responsible for 9/11. He was working with Osama bin Laden. Turns out that is factually incorrect. It didn't happen. It didn't happen. It didn't happen. So that's untrue. We went to war based on that, and it turned out not to be true. But then they said, okay, well, he has weapons of mass destruction. Well, that's not true either. And by the way, let's say it is true, even though it's not. They pretended like Saddam was going to launch immediately, like Cleveland was going to be destroyed in a heartbeat. But again, they made that up. Even if he did have them, which he didn't, this idea that he would launch, Saddam is not Osama bin Laden. Saddam is a Ba'athist. So he's not, you know, up his own ass with his religious fundamentalism. The Ba'athists are relatively secular. So he knows if he launches against the U.S., he would be destroyed immediately, and he wouldn't want to do that. And then they just move the goalpost to what? Well, he's just a bad guy. When all else fails, just go, ah, he's a bad guy. Well, there's a lot of fucking bad guys around the world. We do business with a lot of bad regimes. It doesn't mean you go in there and topple them and you let Americans die and you kill civilians on the other side. That's not a rational standard. So I leave it to you guys. You can make your own mind up based on these numbers, I think. Was it worth it? Was it a pretty good deal that we got Saddam Hussein? And also, isn't it true that what we have now in Iraq is significantly worse than Saddam Hussein? Don't get me wrong. Saddam Hussein was a brutal dictator. This is a guy who was horrendous to the Kurds and horrendous to the Shias. I get all that. But wasn't Iraq in a better place and wasn't it more stable when you had Saddam Hussein in power? I don't think Iraq should have existed in the first place. It's a fake country that was made in the 1930s by Western powers. It's really three separate countries put in one. But when they drew the borders and they sealed the fate, after Saddam Hussein was in power, why the fuck should the U.S. get involved and topple him and fuck up the region even more? You know, I mean, again, wasn't it better off under him than it is right now? I think if you look at the cost of it, which I just went through for you, that answer is pretty clear. Okay. Now, good googly moogly, bitch. All right, what am I going to get to here? Let me get to, I'm not done with Jeb Bush. I think it's absolutely necessary to continue to destroy him. So now I go to his comments on torture. Jeb Bush was at an Iowa Republican campaign event, and he was asked if he would rule out enhanced interrogation as president, a.k.a. torture, let's just call it what it is. And you can imagine where this is going. Here's what he said. Quote, I don't like to make or I don't want to make a definitive blanket kind of statement. That doesn't sound very promising to me. The Guardian reports on this. Quote, Jeb Bush said he believed the techniques were effective in producing intelligence, but that, quote, now we're in a different environment. He suggested there may be occasions when brutal interrogations were called for to keep the country safe. That's why I'm not saying in every condition, under every possible scenario. That's what Bush said. Yeah. Say it with me, guys. www.stepasidebitch.com. We're past this, man. We're over this. Apparently, you don't understand how dark of a period that was in American history. When the U.S. government, which pretends to care about democracy and freedom, says, man, should we torture? Fuck it, let's go to work. We're the people that lecture the rest of the world about morality and the way they're supposed to live their life. And then we decide, well, I mean, come on, we're the good guys by definition. So if we do sleep deprivation, if we do anal rape and anal feeding, well, I mean, come on, we mean well, so let it go. By the way, they admit that at least 20% of the people that we did that to, innocent, died. Somebody got hypothermia and died. They poured cold water on him, and they left him in a cell overnight. He died. It got to freezing, and they came in the next morning. Oh, look, he's dead. And that guy was innocent too, by the way. So Jeb Bush looks at this situation, and he's like, well, I don't want to close the door completely on it. You don't want to close the door completely on something where the debate is already settled. Now, I find it so amazing that neoconservatives think it like willy-nilly, like these things are all of a sudden debatable again. Like, well, I mean, torture, to torture, not to torture, that is the question. Am I right? Difficult moral choice. Why is it a difficult moral choice? If you hear Iran is doing it or Al-Qaeda is doing it or any other nation is doing it that we don't really like, if Russia is doing it, you go, fucking terrorists is what they are. But when we do it, whoa. Should we stop? I don't know, man. I think it's a debatable premise. And by the way, that's also why I'm mad at Obama. Because when Obama did not go after the Bush administration for these crimes, well, then he just made it a matter of opinion. So he makes it that so that Democratic administrations say, well, we're not on board with the whole torture thing because we're somewhat decent human beings. But then when the Republicans get in, they say, well, they didn't prosecute Bush, so why wouldn't I do it? Because I know there's going to be no consequences if I do it. So if I have an ass-backwards opinion that it might work, even though factually it doesn't, well, I could just implement that, and it is what it is. And by the way, we're no angels today either. We outsource a lot of that shit to CIA black sites and whatnot, or we send them to our allies. We might send somebody to Sisi in Egypt and have his punk ass torture them. And we go, well, we didn't torture anymore. We stopped torturing. We just outsource it now. But hey, we literally didn't do it ourselves now. I mean, give me a fucking break, man. These guys, they don't understand how bad of a name they give America around the world. They don't get it. They don't see it. I mean, this is why, according to various polls of all around the world in all different countries, what is the number one threat to peace in the world? The one state which is the biggest threat to peace around the world. The overwhelming majority of people say the U.S. It's not even close. It's not even close. People even look at Pakistan, how Pakistan and India, they both have nuclear weapons and they hate each other, and that's fucking terrifying. People even put, like, Pakistan below us. Russia, which just annexed Crimea, people go, yeah, no, U.S. is still worse. Why? Because they don't view, our Middle East interventions in the same kind of apologetic light that we do, where some people in America, even liberals, say, well, I was against it, but it was a debatable thing. No, it wasn't! It was not a debatable thing! I mean, think about what you're rationalizing and what you're justifying. We did an offensive war against a country that did not attack us. Debate over. Let's move along. And that's the point. The rest of the world does say, well, debate over. The rest of the world goes, you're fighting in over 6 countries right now. That's what you're doing. You still have Guantanamo Bay open. That's extrajudicial. You're not abiding by your own constitution. We think you might be a threat to peace. And what do we say? Forget all the stuff we do. We're the good guys, man. What are you talking about? Are we? Are we when this is the case? When one of the two major political parties in the country is like, well, come on, we think it's debatable whether or not to torture. We like to muse out loud about doing bombings of Iran, for example. Whether it's Representative Duncan Hunter who said we should nuke Iran just to send them a message, or Louis Gohmert saying we should bomb them, or John McCain singing bomb, bomb Iran. I mean, we just invaded Iraq, and we didn't have a rational basis to do it, and then we muse out loud about, well, maybe we'll do it to Iran next. How are people in Iran supposed to think? I would be fucking terrified if I was them. I'd say these motherfuckers are crazy, and they're threatening us. And then again, we turn around to the rest of the world and say, freedom and democracy. You better not violate international law. We violate it all the fucking time. No, this is the problem, man. These guys act in an un-American way. I mean, if you really want to act in a way that is American, what would you do? Take the rational parts of the Constitution, whether it's freedom of speech, due process of law, habeas corpus, etc., and you say, these are off the table, they're not debatable. The Eighth Amendment protects from cruel and unusual punishment. You don't think torture is cruel and unusual? No, that's the thing. You don't believe in the Constitution. You don't believe in the Eighth Amendment. You also, by the way, don't believe in the Fourth Amendment. You don't believe in protection from unreasonable search and seizure because you want the NSA up everybody's ass. So don't say that you care about America and you care about the Constitution. At your core, you're an authoritarian, and everything you say proves that. Whew. Okay. I went to work there, didn't I? Yes, I did. Yes, I did. All right, next. All right, let's do one more, and then we'll take our first break, and then we'll come back, and I'll give you what happened with a program where they drug test welfare recipients. So I want to tell you guys a story about a man named Bernard Noble. Now, Bernard is a victim of the drug war, and his story is indicative of absolutely broken system, in my opinion. So Huffington Post reports on this. They say, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal signed a bill that significantly decreases criminal penalties for marijuana possession in the state, but for some prisoners already serving time on marijuana charges, the state's old draconian drug laws continue to apply. All right, so let's pause here. In some states, they're doing this now, and the main reason why they are doing it is they have overpopulated prison. So it's like, you know, it's a last resort option where they're like, well, I guess we got to let the people out of jail who aren't really criminals. That wacky idea. So they're doing that, but in some cases, and in Louisiana, it's a perfect example of this, they go, whoa, pump your brakes here, son. Okay, from here on out, we won't lock up people who aren't really criminals anymore. But, I mean, the ones we already locked up. Keep them in there. Why not? So, let me give you some details as to Bernard Noble's case, and you'll see just how grotesque this is. They say, quote, take the case of Bernard Noble, a 49-year-old father of seven. Noble is serving more than 13 years behind bars. His crime? Being caught with the equivalent of two joints worth of marijuana in 2010. He has no chance of parole. Noble has seven prior convictions on his record, stretching back to 1989. All of them are convictions for possession of small amounts of drugs, mostly marijuana, but two for cocaine. And all are nonviolent, four misdemeanors, but three are felonies. So they go on to explain in the article that guy lost his house in Katrina, had like his whole life just destroyed. He also, they go through his job history, like he worked at a janitor at one time, he worked for some sort of curtain company, I guess, at one time. He said, my goal and my dream is to be an entrepreneur and have my own small business. Five or six different jobs he worked. And he's very honest, and he says, he's like, look, I mean, I started doing drugs because it was kind of a mental escape from the shitty situation I was living in. I was living in poverty. I was fighting to get out of poverty. And you have to understand, like, if you do some cocaine every now and then, you know what happens? It boosts your mood, and you can deal with the situation that you face. Now, by the way, the sense that I get from the article is that he wasn't even really addicted. Like, this is a guy that fits into the 90% of drug users that are just normal people that can manage and take drugs. So, like, every once in a while, he would do some coke or he would smoke some weed, and he would go about his day. And he's like, look, it just was like a little bit of a stress reliever. And then I could, you know, not hate my shitty janitor's job when I'm trying to become an entrepreneur and work my way up the ladder. So when you learn about this guy's personal history, it humanizes him where you go, oh, my God, what are we doing? Logically, this is no different than taking somebody who likes to drink whiskey, likes to drink Jack Daniels or a couple Coronas after work, taking that person and locking them up. Or somebody who, you know, two or three times a week at work, they have panic attacks, they take Papa Xanax, and then they go about their day and they say, hey, it de-stressed me. Why would we take that person and put that person in jail? But it's the same thing in this case. But what's the difference in this case? Call it what it is. This guy's black. Now, it's just the reality of the situation that the drug war is used primarily to crack down on minority communities. That's why there's a book out about this called The New Jim Crow. We just changed the system of oppression from overt oppression, whether you're talking about slavery or Jim Crow, or official second-class citizenship. We took that and we turned it into, we can't legally do that anymore. I mean, that's too egregious. So, okay, I guess we just criminalize the lifestyle of many people in the black community. Now, again, here's where some conservatives say, oh, well, I don't need to stop doing drugs and stuff, man. Really? So you don't do any substances at all on a daily basis? The overwhelming majority of people do. I hope you know caffeine is a drug. I hope you know Monster Energy is a drug. I hope you know Red Bull is a drug. I hope you know, like I just said, Xanax is a drug. I hope you know Adderall is a drug. I hope you know all these different substances, alcohol, all this stuff. These are all drugs. Some are sanctioned by the state. Some are not. And when you look at the statistics, black and white people use illegal drugs at similar rates, but black people get arrested 4 times more often for it. So you see that all the people who are locked up as a result of the drug war, if they did nonviolent crimes, they're just regular people who have had their lives ruined. Now, here's my proposal. You either fix this or you stop saying you believe in freedom, because this is fundamentally anti-freedom. You can't be for the drug war. You can't be for drug criminalization and also say, I believe in freedom and I believe in individual liberty. No, you don't. It's one or the other, and you should probably come out on the right side of it. Okay, let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about drug testing welfare recipients and how that worked. And later on in the show, we'll get to a silent killer of people, specifically in this case in China. Don't miss it. Stay right there, guys. We'll be right back.
New perspectives lead to new perceptions, like the one you get behind the wheel of the all-new Chrysler 200. One drive and you'll discover why the Chrysler 200's popularity is growing faster than any sedan in its segment. Hurry in to the Chrysler Summer Clearance Event.
Too late for money. Oh, it's time for no thinking.
Guys know about him. We've got done stories on him in the past. He's the guy who proposed, along with Newt Gingrich, he proposed the idea of getting rid of child labor laws. ridiculous. Okay, so now that you have this in context, let's talk about his other genius program here. The Associated Press has a great article out today where they looked into the welfare drug testing program in Maine. Now, the Maine governor, Paul LePage, is a well-known idiot, and he was convinced that this program would save the state a tremendous amount of money. So, now we have the numbers in, and how did that work out? How many drug users did they catch? One. I'm not kidding. Now, to be perfectly clear about this, they did test very, very few people because the way the system works, they only tested recipients who had a prior drug charge. So I forget the exact number, but it was less than 100 people that they tested. But out of those people, one. They found one who apparently was taking drugs. But either way, what they're doing here is they're singling out a specific group of people, namely people on welfare, so people who don't have much money, and they're trying to down on them. By the way, in the state of Maine, there's only 5,700 welfare recipients in total. Maine has a small population anyway. The percentage of people on welfare in Maine is obviously even smaller, so just 5,700. And one was a problem, but nonetheless, they decided to waste some taxpayer money on this. And here's my issue with drug testing welfare recipients. If the idea behind it is, well, you really should test people who are taking government money. If that's the thought process, well, okay, test politicians. But see, that would require consistency. That would require politicians to say, well, I got to hold myself to the same standards as, you know, other people who are taking some form of government money. And they wouldn't do that. They don't want to do that because you and I both know plenty of politicians, are doing one kind of drug or another kind of drug, and they don't want you knowing their business, man. They don't want you piss testing them or taking a vial of their blood or two. They would think that's ridiculously intrusive and invasive. But when you're talking about poor people, come on, they're moochers, they're parasites anyway. What about the moochers and the parasites who, on a federal level, take hundreds of thousands of dollars in farm subsidies as they decry the people who are getting $1.30 per meal to feed their kids in the form of food stamps, which, by the way, is attached in the same bill. In the farm bill, you have the subsidies and you have the food stamps. They scream about the half of the bill, which is the smarter half of the bill, in my opinion, the food stamps, to make sure, you know, kids don't go hungry and shit. And they just give a total pass to, well, you can give me $1 million or $2 million or something over the course of a decade for my family farm, or give me a couple hundred thousand dollars, and that's fine. I'm not a moocher. Because that's how they think, man. Again, it goes back to the tribalism mentality of we're the good guys, they're the bad guys. So if we get to exploit the system, it's not really exploiting it. I mean, we're just doing what any rational person would do. Another example, the bailouts. Why aren't you, obviously, this, you know, in Maine you can't decide to they're not the federal government, so it's a different issue here. But it, for people who think it's okay to test welfare recipients, well, why would you not say let's test everybody on Wall Street who took a bailout? I mean, a lot of these guys crashed their companies, made horrendous decisions, went bankrupt, and then the federal government came in and said, I got your back, son. And they just gave them all a bailout, middle-class tax money, and they hosed us and helped them out, even though they were directly responsible for the crash. But in that case, they never said, hey, there's some strings attached to this. Piss in this cup, and also let me come up with other rules for you that, you know, you have to follow. Nope, nothing. And by the way, it would be unreasonable to say piss in the cup. I think that's stupid. But there should have been other rules associated with it. But, I mean, this is what I'm talking about, man. It's this mindset of, well, the poor people, they don't really deserve it. And what? These poor people who are on welfare have never held a job. They've never paid any taxes. Typically, the way a safety net works is when you're working and when times are good for you, you pay your taxes. Some of it goes to the safety net. And then if/when you fall on hard times, you get it as well. It's a rational system the way it's set up. But in the eyes of some people, they say it doesn't matter if a poor person has worked or hasn't worked or anything like that. No matter what, if they take a fucking penny of tax money, piss in the cup, and then let me try to kick you off the program and waste money in the process. All the states that have implemented plans like this, guess what? They've net wasted money. They didn't do what these guys thought they would do. Oh, my God, we're going to save so much money, yada, yada. No, you wasted money. And in conclusion, real fast, let me say this. If you're unemployed, you've been looking for a job, you can't find a job, and you're down on your luck, there's never been a better time to get high. Keep it real. If you're not high in that situation, I think you're worse off. Okay, this idea that it's automatically immoral, it's automatically unethical, and you're automatically a piece of shit if you can't find a job and then you spark up. Nothing could be further from the truth. That's how a normal person reacts. What the fuck do you expect somebody to do all day? Sit there and stare at the wall and go, my life sucks. No, after you try to get your shit together, well, then you come home and you go, okay, I tried hard to find a job today. I tried to do this and that. I got to relax. I got to cut loose. Either give me a couple drinks or let me smoke some weed. I mean, again, I cannot stand the black and white thinking of the silly conservative Republicans, especially in some states like Maine, like Governor Paul LePage. Okay. Now, let's move along to oh, God. I couldn't believe the story when I read it, but there's one fact in here that's even more amazing than the story itself. Raw Story is reporting on a jaw-dropping story about abortion. They say the following, quote, an 11-year-old Paraguayan girl who was raped by her mother's boyfriend gave birth on Thursday, rekindling the uproar over authorities' refusal to let her have an abortion. The child, who was 10 when she was raped, gave birth by C-section to a girl that weighed 8 pounds. The pregnancy came to light when the girl went to the doctor with stomach pains in April. Doctors initially believed she had parasites, but discovered on examining her that she was 5 months pregnant. Get this, man. So, 11 years old. She's 4 feet 6 inches tall, and she weighs 75 pounds. That's what she weighed before her pregnancy. This story made me sick to my stomach. Now, Amnesty International said the girl was lucky to even be alive, because you can't really go through that when you're 10 years old, when you're 11 years old. And UNICEF has accused Paraguay in the past of failing to protect girls from sexual predators. But, believe it or not, I still haven't gotten to the most amazing part of the story yet. You ready for this? Mind-blowing fact. They say, quote, every day, two girls aged between 10 and 14 give birth in Paraguay. Every day, two girls between age 10 and 14. All right, man. See, this is lunacy. This is dogmatism. This is holding on to a belief despite all the evidence that contradicts your belief and says your belief is wrong. Now, what I'm talking about is this notion that it's never okay under any circumstances to get an abortion ever. Really? Ever? A 10-year-old girl, an 11-year-old girl, where in many cases they die as a result of this. But it's still, no, it's not okay in that situation. How about when we're talking about a zygote, when it's not even really an abortion? How about then? How about a gamete? How about an embryo? How about you're a day in? How about that? How about just, you guys know what my standard is, pre-viability. So if we're talking about a fetus that does not even have a nervous system, so there is no pain, is it not the mother's choice at that point? Especially if the kid is not going to be born into a scenario where they're wanted and they're loved and they have material well-being and they're going to be okay? It's absolutely, positively unacceptable, man. And what I can't stand is that the same people who would advocate for a policy like this, the right-wingers in America, they're the ones who point to the liberals and act outraged at the liberals' position. What the fuck? Who are you pointing at, son? You better turn that finger right around and point it right back in your face. You want to? You're going to force a 10-year-old girl, an 11-year-old girl, to have a baby. She's 10. She is a baby. So what's going to happen? She has a kid, and then what? What's going to happen? What's she going to do? She's going to go to work? She's going to get a 9-to-5? She's going to be able to afford the kid? Is that possible? It's not even possible. Are you kidding me? I'm fucking 27 years old. I'm a baby. You want to force a 10-year-old to have a baby? No, no, no. I'm sick of it. I'm done with it. And you and I both know the sentiment largely comes from religion. Now, it's ironic because if you actually read the Bible is not pro-life. It's actually pro-choice, quite clearly. There's parts of the Bible where God performs abortions. They say if your wife cheats on you, she should get an abortion in the Bible. But still, the sentiment is derived from that, and they think it's based on their religion. It's certainly a cultural thing. And it's so deeply embedded and ingrained, and the way to defeat it is to push back against it. The way to defeat it is to say, no, you're just wrong. And by the way, as we've discussed in the past, according to the Guttmacher Institute, some of the countries that have banned abortion are the countries that have the most abortions. Now, you say that blows your mind, right? It blew my mind, too. But understand why that is. Because it's not like there, after you ban it, there's all of a sudden, woo, there's no market for it, it doesn't happen. No, then people just have underground abortions. And in that case, you're also putting the life of the mother at risk because you're using fucking coat hangers and infections are absolutely possible. So it's a lose all around in 9,000 ways if you have a policy like this implemented. So the answer is, at the very least, look, we're not saying you got to go full U.S. style and do the policy that I prefer, which is totally legal until 22, 23 weeks, and then after that you can do some regulations, but still have exceptions for rape and incest and life of the mother and fetal defect and stuff. You don't have to go all the way to sanity yet. Baby steps. Ironically, no pun intended. Baby steps. Just do, hey, we're going to allow it up till 12 weeks to start off, okay? Now, in Paraguay, they do say, well, we do have an exception if the life of the mother is in danger. But then every time you bring a case to them, they say, nope, life of the mother is not in danger. They brought this case to the government. The government was like, nope, not in danger. It's a 10-year-old girl! Of course the life's in danger. Of course the life's in danger. So they don't even really abide by it. But let's do baby steps here. Allow abortion in cases of rape and incest, and if the life of the mother is in danger, if the fetus isn't going to make it anyway, and allow it up until 12 weeks, and then we'll revisit this in a few years, and we'll try to talk you into being more sane. But what's pathetic right now is that the year's 2015, and I have to come out here and tell you guys a story about how an 11-year-old girl was forced to have a baby. Absolutely absurd and unacceptable. All right. Let's do, how many more should I do here before we take a break? Maybe one or two here. All right, I got to get to this story, which I've been trying to get to for the past, I don't even know how many days. I was going to just scrap it at this point because it's been so many days, but I think it really merits a conversation. The LA Times has a story out about transgender rights in California prisons, and there's some breakthrough news for the community. This is from a few days ago. I didn't have time to get to it in previous shows, but I want to get to it now. Here's what they say. Quote, California is the first in the nation to agree to pay for a transgender inmate's sex reassignment operation. The state concedes that Shiloh Quinn, or Queen, who entered the California prison system in 1980 as Rodney, suffers severe gender dysphoria that can be treated only by physically conforming her body to her psychological gender. The agreement to settle Quinn's federal lawsuit seeking the surgery was announced late Friday with a brief statement from the Corrections Department that every medical doctor and mental health clinician who has reviewed this case, including two independent mental health experts, determined that this surgery is medically necessary for Quinn. California prison officials had denied the surgery, arguing that sex reassignment was not medically necessary. The state's position was undermined in June when its own expert concluded that Quinn required the operation. They say sex reassignment surgery is medically necessary to prevent Ms. Quinn from suffering significant illness or disability and to alleviate severe pain caused by her gender dysphoria. That was clinical psychologist Richard Carroll who said that. He said it would reduce her, quote, depression, anxiety, and risk of suicide. So I think this is a really important story, and it branches off into a much larger conversation that we can have right now. And I think we can bridge a gap here, and I can help explain something, because this is something that just a few years back I was torn on, or I had different feelings on. So let me explain exactly what I'm talking about here. If you asked me 2 or 3 years ago, and by the way, 2 or 3 years ago, still doing secular talk, still Kyle, the same Kyle you know, similar positions on almost everything, okay? If you had asked me back then, should taxpayers pay for a sex change for an inmate because they want it? I probably would have said, what? Come again? That doesn't seem to make much sense to me. Now, today I have the exact opposite position. I have a firm yes on this. Why do I say yes? Because I'm open to facts. I'm open to experts telling me, sit down and shut the fuck up. You don't know what you're talking about. And it is utterly clear. Cadre of experts here said, no, no. Don't look at this like, oh, it's just a matter of opinion, and he wants to become a she. Like, oh, they just woke up on a Tuesday and said, fuck it, like getting a tattoo. Ah, fuck it. Get rid of my dick. No, what we're dealing with here is a human being who really is going through psychological torture in the sense that he was born a he, biologically, but in essence, his brain is a female brain. This is what we call a transgender person, somebody who was, in essence, born in the wrong gender. Now, that exists in reality. There's overwhelming evidence that that is a thing. Being that that's a thing, and being that these people self-report, hey, when I get the surgery, I'm much happier when I'm done with it. Why would we block it? And if you do block it, isn't that akin to saying if somebody has bipolar disorder or severe depression or something like that, and they have an SSRI that works for their condition, an antidepressant, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. Isn't it very similar to say, I'm not going to give this to you? You have a medical issue that needs attention, and we have the answer here, but I don't want to do it. I don't want to give it to you. Isn't that the same thing? I think it's very similar, and I think you absolutely should do the surgery. Now, I understand, man, it does get a little tricky only because the U.S. is not a country that has universal health care. So it's like there are plenty of transgender people who have health insurance or don't have health insurance, and they're not in jail, and they can't afford their surgery, they can't get their surgery, their surgery isn't covered, and they're just fucked because they can't afford it. And it's like, well, you know, why is it a free transgender person who didn't commit a crime can't get the surgery, but this one did commit a crime and now they're going to get the surgery? It's almost like you're rewarding her for doing the surgery. And my response to that is, I see that huge issue, but I think that we should have a Medicare for all system. I think that we should have universal health care. And I do think that medically necessary sex changes, it should obviously be part of that. If you truly have an issue, and experts say, yes, this is what will help you be better, Well, then the answer is, of course, it should be paid for via tax dollars, like any other health care should be paid for via tax dollars. So my position, being consistent on this, I would say anybody who is transgender who feels like they need the surgery in order to not kill themselves and not be severely depressed, the answer is you absolutely should get the surgery, and it should be viewed through that medical sphere where experts say, it is what it is, you don't know any better. See, that's the thing on Fox News, you know, they were discussing this, and it was all like, they were just scoffing at it. Now you're like, ah, I don't personally get it, so therefore it must be ridiculous. It's not about whether or not you fucking personally get it. You're just lucky enough to be born female and feel female, or born male and feel male. So you just look down at everybody that's not exactly like you and doesn't fit into a neat little box. So you scoffing at it is pretty clearly bigotry. You're married to certain ideas and concepts, and if somebody breaks free from that mold, you're like, no, it can't be. It can't be. I'm not going, oh, tax dollars to fund, you know, your hobby, your crazy backwards idea of changing sex. We don't even believe anybody should do that. It's like, ah, get the fuck over it. You're in 1950, and you don't understand that it's a problem, and it can be fixed only if we gave a shit enough to fix it. We do care enough when it comes to something like depression or bipolar disorder and stuff like that. But people like you just don't care when it's a slightly different kind of issue. You should care. Okay. All right, do I have enough? I guess I could do one more here. We'll go to Brian Fisher. Fundamentalist Christian radio host Brian Fisher thinks that slavery is being brought back, specifically is being brought back to the South. Now, is he looking at, I don't know, Dylann Roof's terrorist attack, where he's a neo-Confederate and he's openly racist? And is he saying, well, that's a good example of it right there. They're trying to bring back slavery. This is fucked up. No, he's not talking about that. But guess which group he is talking about. If I give you three guesses, you'll absolutely nail it. Let's take a look.
The last remaining state in the Union that prohibits the adoption of children into homosexual households. Now, this ban in Mississippi has been challenged by four lesbian couples. They're going to court. They're going to federal court to try to get a judge to rule this unconstitutional and dismiss it on the grounds of what the Supreme Court ruled back in June. So if they are successful, if the homosexual lobby is successful on this, then they will be forcing the state of Mississippi against its will. What do you call that? What do you call that when you force somebody to do something that is against their will? That's slavery. That's tyranny. So the homosexual lobby, perfectly willing to impose their values on the entire state of Mississippi. They don't care what the state of Mississippi believes. They don't care what the representatives of the people have decided. They don't care what the people have decided. They are going to impose their values on us. They are going to legislate morality to us and for us and over us. This is when the people say you can't do that. These are the people that say you never should legislate morality. These are the people that say you never should impose your values on other people. This is exactly what they're setting out to do in the state of Mississippi. And ladies and gentlemen, that's just a form of tyranny. When you compel people to do things contrary to their will, contrary to their conscience, that's slavery as well as tyranny. So you think about it. Who's bringing slavery back to the South? Who's bringing slavery back to the Confederate States of America? It's the homosexual lobby. When you compel people to provide services against their will, that is involuntary servitude. That is slavery. I submit to you that it is the homosexual lobby that's single-handedly bringing slavery back to the Confederate States of America.
Those damn gay slave owners, they're so terrible, aren't they? The homosexual lobby is bringing slavery back to the South. Why? Because they want to have gay adoption in all states in America. This guy's comparing gay adoption to slavery. Bri, give it a rest. we see through you. Every single one of us at this point knows what you're struggling with on the inside, dog. I don't even want to bring it up again because I've hammered you so many times with the facts on that. Ooh, poor phrasing. I don't want to talk about hammering Brian Fisher because he might get his little woodpecker heart. Yeah, oh, yeah, talk again about hammering me, Kyle. No, not that kind of hammer guy. Calm down. How ridiculous! He said, well, the homosexual lobby is forcing Mississippi against their will to do something. It's slavery. Slavery. Forcing against their will. Well, you know, Brian, the civil rights movement forced the southern states against their will to accept black people as equals and end segregation. Was it the civil rights movement that was in favor of slavery? No, he's so concerned. Oh, forcing against their will. Whoa. What about the fact that the state of Mississippi is forcing gay people against their will to not be allowed to adopt? They're saying, hey, we would like to adopt a kid. We're a gay couple, but we'd like to adopt a kid. And the state of Mississippi is saying, no, I'm going to force my will on you and say you cannot do that. Even though you're two consenting adults and you're willing to do this, you're willing to make, you know, this step together, willing to raise a kid together. No, the state is going to impose our morality on you and say you can't do that. What about that example of forcing people against their will? So actually, Bri, you're the one that's in favor of forcing people against their will. I mean, think about it. When gay people say, we would like to get married, Brian says, no, I'm not going to let you. So you're the one that's imposing your view of marriage onto gay people when they say, we're two consenting adults and we would like to get married. You go, no, I'm going to force my will on you and say, you are not allowed to get married. See, you're the one that's actually tyrannical. This is what these guys, they never have an answer for this. I've never gotten a good answer for this. You want to know what a gay bigot would be? See, in his mind, he just said, gay people want slavery, they're the bigots. You know what a gay bigot is? A gay bigot is somebody who says, hey, not only do we want to allow gay marriage, we want to ban straight marriage. We think the only marriage you should be allowed to have is a gay marriage. That would be a gay bigot. Why? Because that would be the opposite of the bigotry we always see amongst fundamentalist Christians who say what? The opposite of that. They say only straight marriage should be allowed, not gay marriages. What is the actual position of people in the gay rights movement? They say, whatever floats your boat, as long as you're a consenting adult. So in other words, if you want to get straight married, we're not going to stop you, go right ahead. If you don't want to get married, we're not going to stop you, go right ahead. Or if you want to get gay married, we're not going to stop you, go right ahead. So you know what that position is? It satisfies everybody to do individually what they prefer. Whereas you, Brian, would like to control people and would like to do social engineering, and you do tell people, I'm going to force you to accept my definition against your will. So everything you accuse the liberals of, the sentiment behind what you're accusing the liberals of, is exactly what you're guilty of. It's another classic case of right-wing projection. Okay. Let's take a quick break, and then when we come back, we're going to get into the silent killer, specifically in China. You don't want to miss that story. And I didn't get to the story yesterday. I got to get to it today. The truly entitled people, it's not the poor. It's the super rich. All right, stay right there.
I'm a margarita.
I'll get it.
No, it's fine.
Hey, don't make me fight a stranger.
Whoa! Stop pregnant. Why did you let me do that?
Amazon's Catastrophe is one of the freshest and funniest shows.
That's exactly the response I was hoping for.
It's laugh out loud funny.
I'm actually a favorite.
Dumpster fire.
A bit up and down.
The best new comedy of the year.
You're going to be a champ giving birth. You'll just yawn and it'll fall right out.
Catastrophe. Stream all episodes now on Amazon Video. Free with your Prime membership.
1738. I'm like, hey, with a pillow. Seen your pretty eyes soon as you came in the door. I just wanted chill, got a sack for us to roll. Married to the money, introduced it to my soul. Showed her how to whip it, now she remixed the below. She my trap queen, let her hit the bando. We be counting up, watch our thoughts and band go. We just let it go, talking matching Lambo. 50 feet the ground, broke the 100 grand throw. Man, I'm sure she loved it, how she whipped it down pole. It's the strip club, we be letting bands go. Everybody hates, we just call the fans though. in love with the money, I ain't never let it go. And I get high with my baby. I just left the world, I'm getting fly with my baby, yeah. And I can ride with my baby. I be in the kitchen cooking pies with my baby, yeah. And I get high with my baby. I just left them all, I'm getting by with my baby, yeah. And I can ride with my baby. I'll be in the kitchen cooking pies with my baby. Hit the strip with my trap queen. Cause all we know is fans, I might just send a Ferrari. Buy my boo a lamb, I might just snatch up a necklace, drop a couple on a wreck. She ain't wanted for nothing because I got her everything. And I'm up in the fandom, sitting here on a tango, let me boy try to stand up. Counting the fans, though, how far can your fans go? Tell you what, I'm living 50,000, hey, how I stand, though. Checking for my functions, I'm like, oh, I get high with my baby. I just left them all, I'm getting fly with my baby, yeah. I can ride with my baby. I'll be in the kitchen cooking pies with my baby, yeah. Oh, I get high with my baby. I just left them all, I'm getting fly with my baby, yeah. And I can ride with my baby. I'll be in the kitchen cooking pies with my baby, like hello. In your pretty eyes, soon as you came in the door. I just want to chill, got a back for us to roll. Married to the money, introduced her to my soul. Showed her how to whip it, now she remains from below. She my trap queen, let her hit the bando. We be down and up, watch her fuck them bands go. We just let her go, talking like she's Lambo. 50 grand, 500 grand go. And then I switch and love it, how she whip it down go. The strip club, we be letting bands go. Everybody hating, we just call them fans, though. In love with the money, I ain't never let go. I be smoking dope, you know backwards what I roll. Many boys better eating up, that's for sure. I'll run in your house and up your hoe. Many boys are nothing, many boys are. Oh, I get high with my baby. I just left them all, I'm getting fly with my baby now. And I can ride with my baby. I'll be in the kitchen cooking pies with my baby. Na na na. When I get high with my baby, I'll just hit them all. I'm getting fly with my baby now. And I can ride with my baby. I'll be in the kitchen cooking pies with my baby now. 1738. 1738. Got a sack for Esther. 1738.
All right, we're back, y'all. Let's go to the thing that we should all fucking care about, but nobody's talking about it. According to a new study from researchers at Berkeley Earth, air pollution is killing about 4,400 people in China every single day. That's an amazing number. So here's what they say. Quote, 1.6 million people in China die every year from health issues caused by the country's notoriously polluted air. According to the study, more than one-third of the Chinese population regularly breathes air that would be considered unhealthy by U.S. standards. The study looked at 4 months of data from 1,500 ground stations across China, Taiwan, and South Korea. The research is said to be published in the peer-reviewed journal PLOS-1. Air pollution, particularly exposure to fine airborne particles, can cause a variety of health problems, including asthma, lung cancer, heart disease, and stroke. The World Health Organization said last year that 7 million people die annually because of exposure to polluted air. 7 million people die every year because of that. So the thought that hit me when I finished reading this article is, well, nobody really pays attention to this, or they don't give as much, don't pay as much mind to it, because it's not immediate. whenever we have a threat like this, and it's not right in front of our face, we always go, well, I don't need to think about it now. I got other shit I got to worry about. I got to pay the bills. I got to feed the kids. I got to do this. I got to do that. And nobody goes, whoa, 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 whoa. Some of the biggest killers of people are things that we can absolutely control, like how much pollution we're putting out there in the atmosphere. And they say a lot of this has to do with coal. A lot of this has to do with chemicals that we're dumping out there into the air, different factories and whatnot. And again, all that stuff you can control. So you can cut the numbers of all these toxic emissions, but we don't do it because, again, it's not right there. Like, you can't turn on the TV and see air pollution beheading somebody and then holding up the face. You don't see that, so you don't go, oh, my God, let's wage war on it. It's more like, oh, well, you know, you breathe in the air for X amount of time, and then you're 80% more likely to develop this chronic condition or that chronic condition, and you'll die 12 years earlier. So, like, in essence, they kind of are killing you. It kind of is murdering you, but it's just taking a little longer to do it, and you can't see it immediately. I mean, you might see some smog, but nobody thinks when they see smog, like, oh, my God, where's my AK-47? It's not how they think. So, and this is a theme that we've tried to hit on time and time again in the show, that we're never objective about what it is we fear. So, like, another thing that kills a tremendous number of people is just lack of regulation in the workplace. People develop certain diseases from working extended periods of time in certain fields. Just to give you one example, if you work with, like, asphalt and you pave driveways and you're not always covering your face, you're going to die younger. You're going to die younger. I have, like, a great uncle or something who paved driveways for a really long time, and then he just died super young. Why? Because he got a disease. Because there wasn't proper regulation of his job, which said the company has to provide you with this kind of mask and you have to be away from the asphalt for X amount of time, because even if you're covering your face, the chemicals can get into your body in different ways, etc. That wasn't there. So as a result of that, he died. And this is what happens with so many different positions and so many different jobs. We have such lax regulation, not only in the U.S., but everywhere, that hundreds of thousands of people die as a result of this, and since it's not, again, directly in front of our face, we go, fuck it. We don't need to focus on it right now. Climate change is another perfect example of that. And honestly, sometimes the problem is right in front of our face, and we still don't fucking fix it. Like gun violence, for example, in the U.S., 32,000 people die every year from gun violence. That includes everything, homicides, suicides, accidents, all that stuff. But we go, was the killer a Muslim? No. Okay, it's fine then. Oh, it was a white kid? It was a lonely teenage white kid? It happens. But if it's somebody named Muhammad, oh my God, invade Jordan, invade Syria, invade 26 Muslim countries. Can we do that? Are there that many? Can we try that? So what I would like to see is people just become more objective about what you give a shit about. You know, one of the biggest concerns facing our generation and humanity right now is climate change. Climate change, pollution, environmental issues. Like, we're witnessing the disaster right in front of our faces with increased wildfires, increased natural disasters, the trend lines moving upwards for average temperature. We're seeing it, and everybody's still going, I'm not sure. There was that scientist paid by ExxonMobil who said that climate change might not be happening. So needs more study, needs more science. No, it doesn't. You need more brain cells, apparently. Okay. Real quick before I get on to the next story here, the U.S. flag is going back up in Cuba, the U.S. embassy. In fact, while I'm squeezing this in, right, I got more stuff to get to, but I feel like I should squeeze this in here. Reuters is saying that John Kerry actually went to Cuba. He raised the U.S. flag, and it's the first time that a U.S. flag will fly in Cuba. In 54 years, the first time in 54 years. So we go after Obama quite a bit when it's necessary, but you got to give credit where credit is due. On the issue of Cuba, he's doing the right thing. On the issue of Iran, also, the deal. Fucking fantastic, man. So I always try to make sure, like, yes, attack the shit out of the Democrats when they deserve it, but also give them credit when they deserve it and understand that the crowd that wants to go full false equivalence is wrong. Anytime you hear, you know, people say, well, they're all the same, the politicians are the same. Well, it depends what you're talking about. If you're talking about taking money and being corrupt, yeah, kind of they're the same, but the Democratic, the people corrupting the Democrats are a little less scary. Yeah, they do have Wall Street people giving them money, so they are beholden to Wall Street, but also it's teachers' unions, it's, you know, construction workers, it's lawyers, and that's slightly less scary than fucking hedge funds and the NRA and shit like that and the defense contractors. So there are distinctions, and it is important to do that, to bring them up and know that even though they piss you off 80% of the time, you don't want them to piss you off 100% of the time, and that's what virtually all the Republicans would do. So keep that in mind. So that's some good news. Figured we should throw that out there. All right, now we're going to attack my governor. How about that? New York Governor Andrew Cuomo signed into law a ban on the sale of powdered alcohol on Friday. So the Daily Beast reports on this. Powdered alcohol was approved by the FDA early this year, but has since been banned in nearly half the country. Opponents of the powder, known as Palcohol, I love that name, caution that it may be easier for kids to hide and that it is harder to measure doses. Okay. This actually pisses me off. You want to know why? It's like a weird thing to get pissed off by, right? But it pisses me off because this is like the definition of a solution in search of a problem. You know what I mean? Like, they're acting like, well, come on now. Regular alcohol, well, that's hard for kids to get their hands on, you know? It's in this weird thing called liquid form where they have to drink it, and many kids have not figured out how to drink yet. It's this complicated process that requires years and years of training. They just haven't figured it out. No, they know how to do it. They know how to do it, and it's pretty fucking easy to get your hands on alcohol. It's already in liquid form. They know. They're acting like, what, there's some sort of ridiculous thing that goes hand-in-hand with drinking alcohol that kids haven't figured out yet. So that's safe. We can keep regular alcohol. But powdered alcohol, oh, fuck, man. No, you know what it is? It's just this is an example of the government getting too involved in people's private lives. I mean, there are countless examples of kids getting their hands on regular alcohol and, you know, drinking and then crashing a car or drinking and drinking too much and needing to go to the hospital, or the list goes on and on and on of all the problems associated with regular alcohol. And you know what your response is when that happens, politicians? You say, hashtag freedom, bitch. That's what you say. You want to know why? Because it makes sense to say that. Because what are you going to do? You know, 10% of the time something shitty happens with alcohol and somebody becomes an alcoholic, or this happens or that happens. But 90% of the time somebody enjoys themselves and relaxes. So you say, hey, it is what it is. What are you going to do? Freedom. That's what it is. But when it comes to powdered alcohol, so now this new product hits the market and you say, well, I'm outraged. This fucking stuff is in powdered form, goddammit. Well, look, most people who drink it are probably going to mix it and drink it the right way, where they actually have it as a drink form and they make their own drink with it. Some people are going to snort it, and guess what? I don't really give a shit. They say, well, it's harder to measure. Well, then put on the fucking package how to measure it properly and put it in big letters, you asshole. I mean, if there's a bottle of Jack Daniels, yeah, if you drink that whole thing, you're going to fucking die. But people figure it out after a while. The same thing with the powdered alcohol. You can put it on the fucking package, and if you don't, people are still going to figure it out, man. See, that's why when it comes to social issues, I actually am more comfortable saying I'm more of a libertarian. Because libertarians, when it comes to social issues, they're almost like, obviously, not people like Rand Paul, who's libertarian-ish, but real libertarians. On social issues, they're almost totally like hands-off. You know, whatever it is, whatever fucking drug you want to take, you know, whatever you want to do in your fucking bedroom, as long as it's consenting, go right ahead. Sometimes progressives, you know, flirt with authoritarianism, and they do stuff like this. Like Andrew Cuomo fancies himself a progressive. And he's like, ban this thing because I don't like it. The fuck are you doing that? You have a lot more in common with idiots on the right when you do that. That's pretty fucking authoritarian. And it's not like there's a laundry list of problems that have happened as a result of this, you know, powdered alcohol. But you say, let's nip it in the bud before that happens. Well, I view this as no different than I want to ban weed edibles because, ooh, they're so evil and wrong. Well, no, the way you approach this is you efficiently regulate it and you're smart about it. So when it comes to edibles, no, you don't ban them, but you have them dosed properly and you have it clearly written that this is a good dose, don't take more than this, et cetera, et cetera. And then you let people do whatever the fuck they want to do. You want, in some places, I think they got rid of like the fancy packaging for like weed candy because then kids want to take it, and sometimes they do. Well, they're going to want to take it anyway, but you get the point. They say, don't use the colorful packaging because it could be misleading, yada, yada. Okay, whatever, fine. If you want to use that as a regulation, I'm not going to argue against you, but don't ban it. Don't ban it. Same thing with this. Oh, you don't like it for reasons X, Y, and Z. Fine, regulate it. Don't ban it. Once you ban it, you're crossing the line from being reasonable and trying to create a more efficient system and caring about freedom. You cross that line and just get into, me no likey, so it shouldn't exist. That's far too big government to get involved in your personal life. All right, we may finish early today, man, which would be the first time ever that happened in secular talk history. I do have two more to get to, though. So we'll see what happens. Bring the mood down here, and then I'll bring it back up. Raw Story is reporting on a heartbreaking story of child sexual assault coming out of Florida. They say, quote, a 21-year-old Indiana woman accused a couple who she lived with in Port St. Lucie, Florida, of physically and sexually abusing her for 5 years and using scripture from the Old Testament to justify it. The accuser says that she was sent to live with Rob and Marie Johnson after the death of her mother 9 years ago. The then 13-year-old was sexually abused by Rob Johnson virtually from the day she arrived in the home. They continue, Rob and Marie Johnson reportedly believe in Old Testament law regarding marriage, under which a man can have many wives who are ultimately his property. The girl was ordered to call Jeff Master and to submit to his and Marie's sexual advances whenever they ordered her to. The Johnsons reportedly preyed on the young girl's fear of being abandoned by telling her that if she wanted to be part of their family, she had to have sex with them. Wow. So, an absolutely grotesque story. They've now been arrested, which is good. And one of the things that bothers me the most about this is that it's almost like they have this justification there, and people don't even know that that justification is there. You know what I mean? So when people talk about, especially right-wingers, when they talk about biblical marriage, what do they say? Oh, well, one man, one woman is what the Bible says. Now, that's not correct. So they think that's the case. That's not the case. If you actually read the Bible and you go through it, there's all different kinds of relationships in there. The most common one is polygamy, and this is what we're talking about here. And this guy, in essence, did, you know, child sex slavery to a certain extent. Oh, that's in the Bible, too. That, you know, and what else do they have? They have, force marrying a child to their rapist. That's basically what happened here. They also have guys chopping off their dick and balls and living lives of celibacy. I mean, any kind of backwards-ass sexual thing they have in the Bible. Another one. I forget, what was it, the story a lot in the Bible? I'm not sure if it's a lot, but there is a story in the Bible where daughters get their dad drunk and then rape their dad because they want to have their dad's baby. Hashtag biblical marriage. That's what we're talking about right there. So what bothers me is that everybody, you know, so many Christians in America, oh my God, Jesus, 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 Bible, 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 biblical values, Christian values, Christian values. And then, you know, you read a story like this and you go, oh, okay, so here's what it actually says in the Bible, and here's a guy who did it. And you go, this is a problem. This is a problem. They have this intellectual, philosophical, ideological, religious backing for what they're doing here. And meanwhile, the rest of the population is like, well, what do you mean? The book is totally benign, bro. It's got nothing wrong with it. Really? What about that part? What about the parts that have slavery in it? What about the parts that allude to the earth being flat, where they talk about the four corners of the earth? You know, what about the seven-headed dragons? What about the talking snakes? What about the women cannot teach men anything ever? What about Women on their period can't be in the same house as men can. You can't wear mixes of two different fabrics. Don't eat shellfish. Don't cut your hair. The list goes on and on and on and on and on. All these things are there. All these things are ridiculous. And if somebody actually believes it and implements it, oftentimes you can get something like this that fucking happens. You know, there's a great article in the New York Times today about how ISIS is not only doing child sex slavery, as they're doing it, they're explaining to people who are new with them, oh, no, bro, it's totally cool. Look, here, I'm pointing to a verse in the Quran, and you can see that, and we have theological backing for it. So rock and roll, bitch, you're doing the moral thing. See, they don't even think like, I'm kind of being a fucked up guy, but I'm going to do it anyway because fuck it. No, they're like, oh, no, I am moral for doing this. This is right for me to do this. Man, that's horrendous. Now, understand. Do I think that if everybody becomes an agnostic or an atheist or a secularist tomorrow that all this will go away? Of course not. Of course not. There's still going to be fucking creepers out there that do bullshit like this. But is it possible you could cut the number of people who are doing it simply by getting rid of the ideological backing for it? I do think that's possible. If you cut it by 10%, 20%, 28%, whatever the fuck it may be, even 4%, can you cut it by removing the ideological backing for it? I think you can. I absolutely think you can. And that's why we kind of need to fight this battle and win this battle. Look, I get it, man. Every time I talk about religion, I try to stress the idea that there are good people and bad people in all different religions. That's obvious. And some people cherry pick the good parts and some people cherry pick the bad parts. But why not just dump the entire thing if you know you're cherry picking? If you know you're just reading half it and saying, oh, I like that part better, well, then aren't you, by definition, being disingenuous because you have to disregard the other half and you have to disregard the contradictions and you have to disregard the nonsense? I think the answer to that is pretty clear. I know some people disagree with me, but I don't know. I think that maybe I'm too optimistic in that. I think human beings, most human beings, I should say, can easily live life with a scaffolding that's not a mental scaffolding that's from thousands of years ago and it's a silly book written in the desert. I think that you can have a mental scaffolding from being raised by good parents, from rationally thinking out what makes sense and how to navigate your way through this world, through reading even fucking, I don't like self-help books. I think a lot of them are somewhat scammy, but even those are significantly better than the shit you read in religious books. There's a million and one ways to navigate your life properly, and fully none of them require myths that also have barbarism tied in with it. Okay. Next. Final story of the day, final story of the week, because that's how we do it. Let's bring the mood back up here and laugh. The wealthy son of a Swiss millionaire was sentenced to 2 years probation and a $33,000 fine after he torched his Ferrari 558 so that he can use the insurance money to buy the newest model. I don't even want to continue with the story because I'm seething with anger. Anger is pouring out of my eyeballs right now. Are you serious? Who does that? Even if you're a spoiled prick, in the history of spoiled prickishness, nobody's gone this far. Huffington Post reports, quote, the Ferrari was one of 15 luxury sports cars that the 20-year-old owns. The Ferrari was a gift from his father. Oh, really? I thought he earned it himself. And he told a judge he was afraid of asking his dad to buy him a new one. The young man arranged to get a massage as an alibi. Even his alibi is douchey. Oh, yeah, I was getting a happy ending from a gorgeous Swedish model as they torched my car. So he arranged to get a massage as an alibi, then had some arsonists drive the car to Germany and set a fire to it in an industrial lot. Get this. Authorities weren't fooled by the plot and traced the arson back to him through phone records and surveillance video. This son of a bitch was texting about it. Wait, you didn't realize that when your shit catches on fire, that they're going to do an investigation. And part of that investigation is, let me see your phone records. You didn't realize that? Really? And people like to say, so many people hold this casual opinion of like, well, Adam Carolla, for example, said it. He's like, I think rich people are just better than poor people. He said it. In fact, I think we covered the story on it. And if we didn't cover the story on it, the clip is out there on the internet. Believe me, I've seen it 3 or 4 times, okay? Well, I just think rich people are better than poor people. Ah, poor people are lazy. The rich people, the work ethic. What about this guy, buddy? Is this not a wrench right in the middle of your theory? Is that not what that is? Oh, come on, man. You know it is. There are plenty of this guy out there. I don't know his name. I don't care to know his name. There's plenty of Paris Hiltons out there. There's plenty of Donald fucking Trumps out there. Donald Trump's daddy was worth $400 million. His kid was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. He was born on third and thought he had a triple. And then he takes advantage of the laws, according to his own words, files for bank, over-leverages companies, files for bankruptcy, fucks over working people, takes the money, and then goes, oh, I'm a business genius. I'm a business genius. And the businesses that he's part of that succeed, what is it? He sells his name out to other companies where they just slap Trump on the fucking building. That's not a business genius. If I was given a $400 million head start, I would not go bankrupt 4 or 5 times like Donald Trump. So I'd be a better businessman than him, but I don't have a $400 million head start. You don't have a $400 million head start. There are plenty of rich people who are pricks. There's not a direct correlation between IQ and wallet size. This should be obvious, and to reasonably intelligent people, it is. But people hold that belief. Now, here's the most important point. Conservatives tell you, well, the main thing we're against when it comes to economics is entitlement. I can't have entitled pricks walking around out there, man. Now, that's the reasoning they use to cut government. In reality, those people, of course, are not entitled. If you're getting $1.30 a meal so that your kid doesn't starve, are you entitled? You're nowhere near entitled. You're barely hanging on, and you need that as a lifeline. So that's not the real entitlement. Every modern nation in the world has a better social safety net than we do. Ours is very meager. And it's not like they're all, they're lazy. None of them work because they get, you know, some money to feed their kids when they need it. No. What's the real entitlement in this society? You're looking right at it. When you have people who become billionaires or multi-millionaires, and then when they die, they pass off almost all the money to their kids, and then the kid doesn't have to work, they never learned any values or work ethic, and then they, you know, they do shit like this, and they're just spoiled brats for the rest of their life. This is real entitlement. So if anything, it's conservatives who should call for an estate tax more than liberals should. Now, again, I'm not unreasonable. I don't want to take all your money away and say you have to start from zero. Of course not. That's ridiculous. I still want you to have a decent living situation. So I'm not going to take all the money from you, but should there be a hefty tax on somebody who's going to inherit $1 billion? Is it wrong of us to say, you know what? Maybe instead of $1 billion, you inherit $100 million. If you think that's irrational, I think you're irrational, okay? Because you create these monsters when you don't do that. And by the way, even I'm being possibly too kind on the spoiled little pricks. So there's a good argument you should only leave them with, you know, $5 million, something like that. But anyway, you can see here the real problem with entitlement, not only in the U.S., but all around the world. It's not the poor who are still working and struggling and trying to get by and do the right thing, who need to do that. No, it's more lazy, spoiled, rich kids who get handed everything just because they're part of the good sperm club. Okay. Break time, or I should say, we're done, son. I'll see you guys on Monday. Love you. Peace.